Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and it is my pleasure to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026 during Long COVID Awareness Week. This year, as in past years, I have the pleasure to interview clinicians and researchers from all over the world whose critical work is dedicated to ME/CFS, Long COVID, and infection-associated chronic illnesses. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and I pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, not just the lyrics, actually, the music is beautiful as well, I can't help to imagine a world where the brotherhood of man, woman, is celebrated globally. And for our listeners, a world without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, clinical services, and cures. In my view, that's something not only worth imagining, but actively visualizing and making happen. To help us understand how we may achieve that, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Emmett Tippett to our podcast series today. Dr. Tippett is Director of Clinic 19. She is Clinical Research Fellow at Burnet Institute and also the Visiting Medical Officer of Infectious Diseases at Eastern Health. Emma began her career in basic science research before pursuing a medical degree and specialising in infectious diseases. Throughout her training, she remained committed to research, contributing to multiple projects that deepened her understanding of disease mechanisms and patient care. This foundation in both science and medicine shaped her approach to clinical practice, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. Emma immersed herself in all aspects of COVID-19 care and played a key role in establishing ambulatory care networks for acute COVID-19 in Victoria and provided medical support for healthcare staff experiencing post-COVID syndrome, long COVID. My goodness, we all remember that. Recognising the lack of dedicated services for people with long COVID, Emma founded Clinic 19, a pioneering private clinic designed to address the ongoing needs of patients. Driven by a genuine commitment to finding effective treatments and ultimately a cure for long COVID, Emma has returned to research at the Burnet Institute. Her work bridges clinical care and research with the goal of improving outcomes for people living with long COVID. Emma Tippett, welcome to Emerge Australia's podcast series.
Thanks, Anne, for having me.
So, I mean, what a background. You have experience, significant experience in both basic science research and clinical practice. Can you talk a little bit, you know, about how you got there and how your early research experiences have actually shaped your approach to patient care and influenced the decisions that you've made to specialise in infectious diseases?
Thanks, Anne. Feels like it's going back a long way. So I guess in high school, I was always interested in research and I always felt that the greatest impact to the largest number of people is through finding novel therapies and understanding biological pathways. And so I've always been interested in basic science and the bigger picture of a disease process. And I've also, you know, all infections have always been fascinating, even as a child. From high school, went into biomedical research and started my PhD at the Burnet Institute in HIV research. And I had a wonderful mentor and PhD supervisor, Dr. Susan Crowe, Professor AO Susan Crowe, who was one of the leading professionals in HIV research. So my interest in the crossover between the biological understanding of HIV and the clinical translation started there. And I guess through her leadership, she was also an infectious disease physician, I decided to change tracks and head into medicine with the intention of circling back around into research again. It's taken a very long time, so I guess I don't think I really realised how long the training is to finish your training as a doctor. So probably about 10 years behind schedule in terms of getting back to research. So that was always the plan to get back here, but then obviously the pandemic happened and it was quite clear that there were going to be long-term consequences of COVID, and we don't understand this disease. We didn't know, or still don't know, what the pathogenesis is and what the trigger is. And I don't think we really understood at the beginning what a global impact it was going to have. So it was pretty clear that there's a huge need to both provide treatment to people with long COVID, as well as work on finding effective therapies and understanding what the mechanism is.
Yeah, a lot of clinicians that I speak to, even researchers, actually had a beginning in HIV. It's quite interesting. So were there similarities there in terms of, you know, because I know at the beginning with HIV, you know, you could have said the same things, couldn't you?
Absolutely. In terms of it being a disease that we didn't understand and not having effective therapies, in that respect, yes, a lot of similarities. There are similarities in that one potential mechanism of long COVID is viral persistence, and that's a major issue in HIV. If we can figure out the viral persistence in HIV, then we can actually cure it. And so a lot of people I work with have a background, including myself, a background in HIV persistence and can use those skills to look at COVID persistence. And understanding the immune disturbances that occur following an infection is also a lot of parallels between HIV and long COVID.
Yeah. And I'll just mention this once because, of course, you specialise in long COVID, but from your wide knowledge and expertise, you know, if you discover that, is that going to be helpful for people with ME/CFS?
I really think so. There's a lot of people have different hypotheses and I guess preferences for what the mechanism of long COVID is, but clinically it looks very similar to ME/CSF. Thinking about this morning, that there's a lot of things to say. There's a lot of questions. Is it something about COVID, the virus, or is it something that COVID triggers in a person? And if it's something that COVID triggers in a person, then there's no reason that it's going to be significantly different from other infection-induced ME/CSF.
Yeah.
We'll find, I think what the benefit of long COVID is for people with ME/CSF is if we find the mechanisms for understanding what is causing long COVID, then we would translate that and check to see whether or not the same situation occurs in infection-induced ME/CSF. And hopefully we'll find parallels. And further to that, establishing the platforms and the research mechanism. And it's really not a big stretch to stop focusing on long COVID and look at the broader post-infection syndrome.
Yeah. And what about the other infections? So I know that in ME/CFS, Epstein-Barr virus, you know, is at the root of a very, very large percentage of people with ME/CFS. Are the mechanisms basically the same, that there's been a virus, so an Epstein-Barr virus, it lays dormant, et cetera, and then can be reactivated and then that can lead to ME/CFS? Or are there, you know, are there other mechanisms at play? Because it seems that COVID is one virus, but are the mechanisms the same for the other viruses?
Yeah, I don't think we know. I don't need to tell you that ME/CSF and post-infection syndromes are a neglected field of medicine, but we know for sure that EBV is a very common trigger, but it's an incredibly prevalent virus that, you know, at least 80% of people won't get through their teenage years without. But we know that a whole range of other infections that can cause post-infection syndromes, Lyme disease you know, without a doubt, obviously, dengue, Ebola, Ross River, probably most of the tick-borne virus, tick-borne rickettsial diseases, shoe fever. So we know that there's a whole range of infections that can lead to a post-infection syndrome where the bugs are gone. So some of these are bacteria and some of these are viruses. With the bacteria, we're usually fairly confident that the bacteria is gone. And it has been the impact of the infection that's resulted in changes that have led to the chronic fatigue. That's a little bit different from EBV, where we know EBV hangs around for a long time. I think the research, people who specialise in Ross River believe that we do clear Ross River, so we don't think that Ross River hangs around for a long time. So again, that's that's not the persistence of the virus that's causing the post-Ross River. Chikungunya is another really common one for post-viral infection.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. Because I've often sort of wondered, you know, are they all just part of, you know, an infectious disease that has that impact? And I do note that you mentioned Lyme and tick-borne illness not being, so from my perspective, every time I've even, you know, gone anywhere near Lyme disease or tick-borne illness, I get a big no from people in government in terms of, that doesn't happen in this country, does it?
Yeah. Listen, for Lyme, I'll say no, because we know what the causative organism of Lyme disease is. And if from memory, if I've got this right, Burkhardt area, I'm going to embarrass myself if I've got that wrong. Oh, I think I've got that wrong. Anyway.
That would be or something. Yeah, I can't remember. Anyway, yeah.
I'll just quickly Google it. Borrelia.
Yes.
Borrelia. So we can detect that bug. Like, we can go around and squash up ticks and detect it. We can test people's serology for it. And we haven't identified it in Australia, but we have got a whole bunch of other tick-borne bacteria called from the rickettsial family. And we've had scientists in Australia that have really pushed forward the whole rickettsial research field worldwide. And we have rickettsias in Australia that are specific to Australia and not found anywhere else. And I really don't think there's any reason to say that a rickettsia can't cause a post-infectious syndrome. And I'm quite sure that I have seen it. The problem with testing is a little bit tricky to diagnose, that when you do a serology test to see whether or not somebody's had a tick-borne disease in the past, sometimes it can be very hard to interpret, and the antibodies are very sticky, so you get lots of false positives, and it's hard to be really sure whether or not somebody has had a tick-borne virus. So that's where there's a lot of uncertainty about that. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of stigma about using the word Lyme disease in Australia, because people who have unexplained symptoms and are not getting attention from their medical professionals will focus on that as an explanation, because when you read the symptoms, it fits in with what they're experiencing. But there's no reason that it can't be another tick-borne disease.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for explaining that, because, yeah, we, for example, at Emerge Australia haven't got a major focus on tick-borne illness, but it is coming up more and more in the literature, and it's coming up more and more in all sorts of places. And with your science research background, yeah, that was a really good explanation. So thanks for that. I want to switch a little bit to Clinic 19. And hoping you can tell us a bit about Clinic 19, what you do, what services you deliver, but what inspired you to, you know, create Clinic 19? What was the catalyst?
So going back to 2021, 2022, one of the hospitals I worked at had a big outbreak on the wards, and 70 nurses contracted COVID before we had vaccination, before we were actually wearing P2s and N95 masks. And it was Delta strain at that time.
Yep.
And through the hospital I was working at, been fantastic. They allowed me to establish a post-COVID service to check on these nurses to see that they were okay. And we found out they were not okay. And out of the 70 nurses who were caught up, predominantly nurses, 40% were still having symptoms at 7 months after long COVID. And a fair percent, maybe I think it was 11%, were unable to return to their previous roles. These are women who were running the hospitals, that were, you know, working 10 to 12 hour shifts, on their feet the whole time, multitasking, running, you know, emergency codes, and, you know, commonly told that they need to have a rest after they're having a shower. They can't vacuum their floors. They can't do their supermarket shopping. And so these are just people who would not choose to be living like this. You know, there's no possibility that it's psychosomatic or it's anxiety or anything like that. And so recognizing, you know, if we're looking at 40% of the population being affected at 7 months and, you know, we're in for a disaster, fortunately, through the vaccination and through the virus changing to Omicron, it hasn't been as severe as that, but that's really what it could have been.
Yeah.
If we'd let it go, if we'd had widespread transmission of Delta before vaccination, then that's what Australia would have been looking at. So anyway, so recognition that there was a need and that long COVID was going to be a major problem and, you know, just genuine sadness for these people whose lives have been upended. I was working very closely with some allied health and exercise physiologists who were providing one of the first people groups to publicly provide care for long COVID patients in that catchment, or in Australia actually, but wasn't able to establish a specific medical service at that hospital or the other hospital that I worked at through the public system, not through lack of will, but mainly just through bureaucracy and the time it was going to take. And then through a patient coming to me from somewhere else, I found out about a low-dose naltrexone and then realizing, you know, that that patient had significantly improved or had a, you know, major improvement in their level of function based on this off-label medication. And finally, having something that we can actually offer patients and also having the flexibility of telehealth as well. So one thing that specialists have the ability to do is Medicare bill telehealth appointments without a face-to-face. And so that means I didn't have to set up, you know, physical rooms and didn't have to worry about reception staff and all the challenges for setting up a business. So it was really your process of becoming registered, setting up a website and a platform, and then starting to say, okay, I'm happy to see long COVID patients. And within, that was August 2022, and within a month, I put something on the long COVID Facebook page, and within a month, I think I had 150 people on the wait list wanting to see me, so wanting to see anybody who's interested in long COVID. And that's all we started with, was low-dose naltrexone. Pretty quickly became aware of the involvement of POTS in long COVID. So up until this point, I wasn't regularly seeing long COVID patients. So I basically self-educated about POTS pretty quickly, established nasaline tests for the patient to do at home and bring to their first appointment so we know whether or not they've got POTS right from the beginning. And from there expanded from, you know, having one agent, which is low-dose naltrexone, into I think we use about 30 or 40, well, probably about 30 different medications fairly regularly now. And through the clear surge of patients desperate for care and, you know, getting emails on a regular basis saying, you know, I can't work, I can't take care of my kids. It, you know, it was just pretty clear that there were some, you know, devastating stories out there. Just put the word out through my doctor networks for other people who were looking for this type of work. And we've now expanded to, I think about 18 doctors, including pediatrics.
So 18 doctors as part of the one clinic, all seeing patients via telehealth. Is that
right?
That's the way it works. Do your patients, so this is just digressing, do your patients still need to see you once a year in order to be able to access your telehealth services?
Once they've been seen, if it's been more than a year, we'll usually get them back in again sooner. So there's no requirements.
Because that is one of the barriers for other patients that seek to have telehealth services with their GP. They need to go at least once a year. And as you know, so many of people with ME/CFS are bedbound.
That's a restriction of the telehealth. So as I said, the physicians, medical specialists have the ability to do telehealth without a face-to-face, whereas GPs are required to have that face-to-face at least once a year to allow the Medicare rebate.
Yeah,
so we don't have that restriction, which is why we haven't been able to bring GPs into the clinic. I've certainly had plenty reach out and I would love to, and there's no reason they couldn't do it. It's just that restriction on, you know, a government imposed restriction on telehealth.
Sure. Has your model been replicated by others around the country?
I went to The only other clinic specialising in long COVID is the Geelong clinic.
Oh, yeah, Bernard's clinic. Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, there's plenty of, well, individual doctors who are also working long COVID, but nobody's got such a large clinic. I did go to the Boston Long COVID conference a few months ago, and one of the sessions there were about models of care, and most of the people presenting were government supported clinics with a fair bit of allied health support. Ours is all, we don't have any allied health. There were a lot of similarities in the approach and the medical prescribing, but I'm not aware of any other country who's established this. I mean, I think that there are a lot of clinics that specialize in long COVID, but it's always a little bit dubious about what services they're offering and how evidence-based they are.
Yeah. I guess that's the critical thing, isn't it? That being, you know, grounded in the evidence. And I guess your background just positions you ideally for that kind of an outcome.
Yeah, I think it probably means I'm a bit more willing to be experimental with medications than people who don't have a scientific background, which means that we've been allowed to, through working with the patients and getting feedback and also getting, you know, they're bringing in their research that they've undertaken and asking us, what do you think about this treatment that I heard about here? We've been able to expand our repertoire and refine our model and have mostly quite often a good idea. So if they come to us and say, what do you think about rapamycin? We can say, well, we've had five people in our clinic try rapamycin and this is what we think is, you know, what they've reported back on. And that's helped us also have confidence in recommending medication. So as I mentioned, we started with low-dose naltrexone, but we started hearing about nicotine therapy and then, you know, a few of the doctors in the clinic started trying nicotine therapy as well. And, you know, at least three of us were like, yep, we're pretty convinced that this is working. So the other doctors become more confident because we think it's working and we haven't had any side effects or complications from patients. And so the other doctors start using nicotine and we just build the evidence base through clinical experience more so than, you know, hard data. And they become more comfortable in these novel therapies.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to talk to you about off-label prescribing. And obviously, I'm also thinking very much in mind with people with ME/CFS. I mean, we know that for GPs, off-label prescribing can be very, you know, they have to be careful about off-label prescribing. And it seems to me that a lot of the things that you're doing in long COVID aren't necessarily available to people with ME/CFS. Would that be a fair statement?
I think it does really boil down to the risk appetite of your GP. And if you're a GP that doesn't specialise in ME/CSF and you've got one ME/CSF patient and they're asking you for a medication that you've never heard before, like rapamycin, which is an immunosuppressant, your gut feeling is going to be, no way, I don't know what this is. I don't know, it's not going to kill you. I don't know whether or not it's going to work and I'm not going to put myself at risk of having APRA take away my registration because I don't know enough from the clinic. So I think that, you know, that's where specialist clinics are actually really useful because people think about this and they do that. They've got time to do the research specifically about that particular topic. Whereas when you're in GP land and you're, you know, the next person you see is going to be a pap smear and the one after that's going to be something else, you don't have time to do the deep dive into one drug.
Yeah. It seems to me that the model that you've developed is a brilliant model and I find it really difficult to understand why, you know, that kind of model couldn't be, you know, replicated so that people around the country can have access. I mean, with telehealth, people can have access to you anyway, but then again, you've only got so much time to see so many patients.
So we're national. We do see people internationally and through being able to get enough doctors on board, we are almost through our wait list, which is for the first time in 3 years. So that's good. So we are able to provide care to the people who are asking for care. So that's a major achievement. If we ever run out of work in long COVID, then we'll start seeing ME/CSF patients. But there's no reason that a specialist couldn't do the same service in ME/CSF specifically. I think that the barrier is convincing the doctors to come and join your clinic. And that's a hard sell for ME/CSF and long COVID.
Yeah. What are the barriers then for them? You know, why is it a hard sell?
Yep. In the beginning, it's because, you know, there's still a prevailing belief that there's nothing that you can do and it's just time. And so, and, you know, doctors don't like taking care of chronic diseases where there's no cure. So it's a lot of, when I started having to try and convince doctors to come join the clinic, it was about convincing them and showing them that there is actually a whole bunch of things that you can do to improve somebody's function. So it might, you know, we're still not curing people and, you know, I still have plenty of patients that I haven't been able to budge at all. But for the majority of patients, you can make a difference. And explaining that to doctors that we do have treatment options, we do have investigations we can do, like we can diagnose and treat POTS and we can do that via telehealth. And just managing POTS alone without even addressing post-exertional malaise can, you know, result in a huge functional improvement in somebody who's severely orthostatically intolerant. So convincing the doctor that they actually can have an impact is the first thing.
Yeah.
And it boils down to the belief that we were told through medical school that there's nothing you can do for ME/CSF and it's only going to take time and it's a, you know, depressing field of medicine and nobody wants to take it on.
That's a shame, isn't it? I know that through Emerge Australia's Medical and Scientific Advisory Committee, and you are a member of that committee, one of the areas of focus is going to be how we can impact the training of young doctors coming through the various universities. It does seem to be a major barrier, and I know from other disease areas that I've worked with, when young grads feel that there's not much hope in an area or it's not particularly sexy or, you know, there's not an awful lot you can do, that they sort of steer away in droves.
Yep.
And therefore, you know, you don't get that interest from young up-and-coming doctors that one would in cardiology, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right.
And so that's why, the focus of looking at the whole curriculum of young doctors coming into medicine is really critical. So that's an important point you raised. Can you explain, and I don't know, because you can explain it for me, the concept of an adaptive platform long COVID clinical trial, please, and its potential on impact on the development of treatments for long COVID?
So adaptive platform trials are a new model of clinical trials which are pretty rapidly being taken up. So a traditional clinical trial is you have drug X, and to test whether or not drug X works, you enroll however many people that your power calculation has determined, so let's say 1,000 people, and you put 500 people to receive drug X and 500 people to receive the placebo. And then they do that for however long the study goes for, and then you stop. And then you do the analysis, and that's it. And that's the end of the trial. The adaptive platform trials are less focused on the specific drug and, you know, one trial. They're more focused on establishing a platform, that's the name that suggests, that allows modifications to the clinical trial to go along an early analysis. So you don't need to do the whole clinical trial. So for example, in drug X, if drug X doesn't work, all those people, all that time, all that money has been wasted, and you're not going to find out until 6 months after the trial ends. With an adaptive platform trial, an interim analysis is written into it at a certain point. So in that example, with drug X, you would do the analysis at, say, 100 people, and if it's quite clear that the drug is not working at that point, then you can stop the trial. You can stop that arm of the trial there and think about swapping in another drug to have a look at, using the same people, the same platform, the same methods. And so you've got everything established and you haven't wasted all that energy on a drug that's not going to work. And so the adaptive nature of this style of trial is very suited to long COVID, where we have a clear disease, but we don't have a clear understanding of the pathogenesis, nor do we have very strong candidate drugs to test. And so what we need is a flexibility to be able to say, okay, we've got this drug candidate, let's test it. Oh, that didn't work after a very short period of time, let's try another one. And keep on going. And it's very unlikely that we're going to ever find one drug that does everything. And so it might be that you can do sub-studies and deeper dives into your cohort. So it might be that, okay, we found this drug and we found that 40% of people actually responded really well. Let's go find out about what it is about those 40% of people. And then we then have a diagnostic test to say, we think this drug is going to work in you. And then for the next adaptation of the clinical trial, we then look at the 60% who it didn't work in, and then we try and find them another treatment. And so it's just that constant changing and having the flexibility to adapt.
Thank you for explaining that, because I didn't properly understand it. You spoke before about POTS and post-exertional malaise. Do you see a lot of people with long COVID with post-exertional malaise?
Oh, everybody. I don't think it's long COVID if they don't have post-exertional malaise.
Right. So at what point, because this is always a bit of a debatable subject, at what point in the long COVID journey do people actually transition according to what the evidence says, into satisfying the diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS. Well, it seems to be a sort of a continuum that, I mean, I certainly, because I'm not a medico, but I don't understand. But, you know, do you see it? Are you conscious of it? Or do you say, no, they're all long COVID?
No, I think they all reach criteria. You know, whatever the criteria, I think it's 6 months. I think, yes. When you're talking about a post-infectious fatiguing syndrome due to COVID, I think they all reach ME/CFS criteria.
Right. So that's really interesting to know. So the next question I want to ask you is about antivirals. It's a little bit of a pet topic of mine because we hear from a lot of people with ME/CFS who, you know, get COVID, but they're not eligible.
Yep. And the same for people with long COVID who know that they're at a major risk of a significant relapse unless they do something, and they're not eligible either because it's an invisible illness.
We're trying very hard. We're going to put another submission forward. We've already put one forward that got no traction whatsoever. I know Bernard's tried to do a lot about it. I mean, others have, you know, gone to great heights to speak to people about it. I mean, that needs to change, doesn't it?
I agree. Yeah, I agree that people with ME/CFS should be eligible for Paxlovid. However, just I guess to be a little bit more reassuring for the people who can't access Paxlovid, it's not the be all and end all. So there's a few issues with Paxlovid. So the studies that looked at Paxlovid in acute infection and whether or not that it's had an impact in the development of long COVID have been fairly equivocal. So there's been some studies that show a where, you know, possibly a reduced risk of developing long COVID and others that haven't shown any, but it's going to be a minor benefit. Personally, I think that's because a 5-day course of Paxlovid is not long enough. It's quite common and well recognised that after 5 days, people will have a rebound in their viremia and actually become RAT positive again. So you need to suppress the virus longer. So Paxlovid does work as a viral suppression, but it's just not long enough to do what we need for long COVID. There was the study called COVID Out, which you maybe be familiar with, which looked at studying metformin during acute COVID. And they've done a couple of analyses, and it was an excellent study, very well done, very convincing. And they showed that people who started metformin within 2 weeks of acute COVID had a 41% reduction in the risk of developing long COVID. And that's incredible. That's the most effective prevention that we've got. Yeah, there are limitations to the study. It was only in people who had a BMI above, I can't remember, 25 or something.
A very large percentage of people.
Well, yeah, I guess so. And you can use metformin in people with normal BMI. It's just that the study didn't. So we haven't shown that it will work for people in a normal BMI range. But that the doses they used were fairly rough. So you get a lot of gastrointestinal side effects when you go up to the doses that they were using, but it's still worth it. The other then, I think based on those findings, there was a linkage study in the UK where they looked at starting metformin following acute infection out to 3 months, and they still showed a benefit of reduced incidence of long COVID in people who started metformin 3 months after their acute COVID infection. And so that is actually way more effective than Paxlovid in prevention.
Yeah, wow.
My understanding is metformin started off as an influenza antiviral. Could be wrong on that, but that was... somebody told me that. And so there's a chance that metformin might work for influenza as well in terms of protection of
relapse. Well, I thought metformin was primarily used in diabetes.
100%. That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I hadn't heard that at all.
Yes, we use, for people who are not eligible for Paxlovid, actually for everybody, we use metformin as our primary relapse prevention for acute COVID. And if they're eligible, if we can get them Paxlovid on the PBS, we will, or we'll offer them a private script and they can pay for it if they want. But I think that you get more bang for your buck for metformin, which is a very cheap and safe drug.
Yeah, absolutely. Easily prescribable by GPs. I could go on and on and on because every time you say something, it leads me into another direction. But can you just give us a little bit of a snapshot into some of the research that you're currently involved in or that you are able to talk about? And, you know, is there anything exciting on the horizon research-wise that you're doing?
Unfortunately, funding's an issue as always, funding and time. So we had 12 months of funding, but that's now finished.
Yeah.
From a clinic point of view, I've got some excellent doctors who are really keen in this. And so one of my doctors has just submitted a paper on long COVID and pregnancy, which I think will go very well. Another doctor's writing one on clots and doing a meta-analysis on microclots in long COVID. And another doctor has published a low-dose naltrexone meta-analysis as well. And so we're bringing out small bits through the clinic. I'm personally looking at a very large study on therapeutics that are used in long COVID. So it's similar to one that was published in ME-CSF last year, but basically asking all of our patients with long COVID to identify all the therapeutics they've used and rank, you know, give an indication of whether how effective they felt they were for their symptoms. And so this will give us some hard numbers about which therapeutics we should be focusing on. And I think that's actually really important because, you know, until the science catches up, all we've got is the individual experiments that patients are undertaking. And if we can pull that, that will give us some really strong signals and, you know, some reasonable evidence to support our prescribing decisions. We've got a number of projects review for funding with the MRFF. Basically, they all tie in. And the idea, what we're trying to establish is a long COVID / post-acute infection syndrome focus group or specialist group at the Burnet Institute, where we go from basic science, including proteomics and machine learning and in vitro immunology, hopefully through a mouse model, into human pilot studies using Clinic 19 patients. And we've got a clinical trial, what's it called, grant submission under review, looking at using four different medications in severely affected housebound people with long COVID as a pilot study, just small numbers. I think it was 20 per arm, but just to try and identify any preliminary signals that tell us which drugs we should be focusing on. And then into, hopefully down the track, we'll be funded for the larger adaptive platform trial. So we can take our findings all the way from the bench in the lab through to a clinical trial and translation into clinical care. So yeah. In terms of the larger adaptive platform trial, that's a long way from being funded. I think there'll be another opportunity to put in an application for that probably this year. But really, without the basic science moving, we still haven't got any novel groundbreaking interventions. I've got ideas, but it's a bit hard to take an idea and put it into an $8 million clinical trial without that basic science having been done first. And so hoping that we'll be successful in these, you know, this preliminary work before we start looking at the adaptive platform trial.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. It does seem to be that there needs to be that continuum developed that, you know, ultimately goes from the scientific bench right through to translation into what does this mean for the patient, you know, and that journey is an important journey with all those different milestones in between. Of course, the challenge is, as you say, the funding. Having said that, the federal government has put $50 million into long COVID research. Is that enough? So from an CFS perspective, the comparison between dedicated ME-CFS research and long COVID is like chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're advocating for more dedicated ME-CFS research. It just seems to me to not make sense. When you say that, you know, nearly all your long COVID patients articulate into ME-CFS, I kind of go, well, why isn't more being done there? I mean, people are saying, you know, if we can get it right in long COVID, then maybe it'll be applicable for ME-CFS. And I'm sure that some of our listeners thinking here would be saying, well, why couldn't you start with ME-CFS?
Yeah. I think from the government point of view, when, you know, we had a pandemic.
Yes.
And then we've had a, I guess you'd also call it a pandemic of long COVID people that has affected the GDP in Australia. And so it's much easier for a politician to focus on long COVID because we can measure the impact and we can define the trigger and it's a lot more contained. So I really feel, and I feel like for those, you know, and we've got many patients in the clinic who had pre-existing ME-CSF and then they've been triggered by COVID, and so we'll see them in the clinic. And I feel very sorry about the decades of self-advocacy and neglect that they've experienced, and to have long COVID just sweep in and get all the attention must be really hard. But I just expect that we will be able to use this to get more attention and more funding and be able to translate that into other post-infectious syndromes.
Yeah. Well, what is your message of hope for people living with long COVID?
I think that there really is some excellent research happening worldwide, and I think the governments are taking it seriously and funding is coming through to undertake that basic research and find some genuine treatments to make a difference. And so I really do think it's unfortunately still going to take some time. I've been saying this since 2023, but I do think we will find effective treatments. We've already gone from, you know, low-dose naltrexone being a very fringe medicine to mainstream medicine in long COVID, and we've now got a few other agents, and I expect that that will just continue to expand over the coming decade.
Yeah, and there's a lot of work happening in the States. I interviewed David Petrino recently. I mean, he's obviously also got work happening with rapamycin, and then there's, you know, others in the US. There's Mestinon and you know, other drugs.
Mounjaro, pirfenidone, a JAK1 in a JAK-STAT inhibitor. There's some good trials happening. We still need more. We're starting to get moving, but we still need more.
We're behind the eight ball compared to some of the other countries, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean the thing is that it's a global disease and it's a global problem, and all the researchers will work together. And so if they find something in one of those international trials, we will be able to use it in Australia and we'll be able to point to it. But that doesn't mean that we should stop trying to figure it out whilst here. And, you know, we've got the infrastructure and we've got the ability to compete with, you know, larger countries, and we can. It's not going to be as simple as one trial and we'll fix a problem. So we're going to need lots of researchers continuing to work on this.
Yeah. Emma, what's your message to the Minister of Health on behalf of Australians living with long COVID, ME/CFS and other energy limiting conditions? What would you say to him if he was here today?
As much as there has been an acknowledgement, there was the government inquiry into long COVID casting a long shadow, and there has been the dedicated MRFF funding, which the minister is well aware of. I still feel it's an invisible illness, and I still don't think that anybody understands the number of people who are in their prime years whose lives have been completely derailed, and the impact that it has on not only that individual, their family, their caring responsibility, their workplaces, the economy, society in general. I really don't think that anybody has in policy has really grasped the impact of taking out this many people who are predominantly women in their 30s, 40s and 50s out of society, and they are invisible and they're not being heard and they're not being treated. So that's my first message, is it's probably much worse than anybody thinks. The second message is I was pretty disappointed with the long COVID inquiry, in that the care for long COVID, the outcome of that was to establish care into the existing chronic diseases pathways in general practice. The issues with this is, of course, general practice is already at a breaking point. General practitioners don't have time to specialise in long COVID. You need specialists in long COVID and ME/CSF to be across all the new literature and the new treatments. And no general GP has the ability to do that. And so I very strongly feel that transferring care of long COVID patients into already overstretched, overburdened GPs who don't know what to do and don't have any supports and don't have any training systems available to them is not the right way to manage this disease.
That's a really strong message, and if I had more time, I'd be going on to ask you a whole lot more questions about that, because it opens the Pandora's box on clinical education, the availability of specialists and the willingness of specialists to take on this disease. And of course, that's juxtaposed against the experience of patients who tell us all the time, whether they've got long COVID or ME/CFS, well, where do I find a doctor who'll listen to me? And of course, patients will in the first instance go to their GP. So it becomes a very, you know, it's not a satisfying loop that patients go through, and they're often still left in limbo despite having such brilliant services and brilliant clinicians like yourself. Dr. Emma Tippett, thank you so much for speaking to us today. I certainly hope that people listening to Emma speak today will have got some very helpful messages. I certainly have learned a lot from you today, Emma. So thank you so much for coming today.
My pleasure, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Today's podcast is part of a clinical series that Emerge Australia is recording People of Influence. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. Tune in again for our next interview and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au or have a look at our clinical resources online. Thank you again, Emma, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join us and the world.